Oral History Committee of Sabre, visiting with John A. Buddy Hassett, whose major league career spanned 1936 through 1942, playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, Boston Braves in the National League, and the New York Yankees in the American, won World Series in 1942. Buddy is living on his own at this point. His wife passed away a couple of years ago. He has two daughters. We're sitting here comfortably. I know I'm going to enjoy his trip down memory lane because I have seen him play many times. And Buddy, the first thing I want to ask you is, I guess we'd have to start the story back in September of 1911.
That's right.
And that's an accurate...
That's September 5th, 1911.
It's an accurate year, isn't it? Because sometimes,
yes,
you know,
right.
The guys either go one up or one down. And you were born and raised in New York. You want to tell us a little about the occasion when you emerged as a member of the Hassett family?
Yes, I was born in 60th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, which is just one block north of Amsterdam. Naturally, 10th Avenue becomes
right.
Amsterdam, so we got into the high rent district, which is one block up.
Yeah.
It was a tenement house, and I was born in the house, and went to school at the Paulus Fathers, which was there at 60th Street.
Uh-huh.
And between 1922 and 24, my dad being a plumber, he bought some property in the Bronx, and with his friends who were in the building trades, they built a home up in the Marshall Parkway area. And one of the unusual things about it was a plumber in that same union with my dad at the time was George Meany.
Uh-huh.
Who later became president of AFL.
Right.
And he helped his brother, who was an electrician, put the electrical work in our house when they were building it, which is something unusual.
Sure.
So, of course, he was a friend of the family's for many years. I used to visit him later when he had his office in Cincinnati, Ohio, when I was playing ball. But then we moved into the house in the Bronx in 1924, and I was there. We went to Manhattan Prep, Manhattan College, from there.
You graduated from Manhattan.
Yes, yep. And
and you must have played ball. Had you played basketball?
Basketball,
as well?
Yeah. I was captain of the basketball team. Yeah, we had a pretty good basketball team at the time, and the Cohallen family,
Neil Cohallen
was our coach. And of course, Neil was quite an athlete himself.
He had a fine record.
Yes, not only that, he played all three sports, and he played them all well in college. And we worked together a little in the trucking business later on, before he passed away. And from there, of course, playing ball and playing a little light semi-pro ball way. Joe Press.
Guy was the manager of the Bushwick.
Joe got an interest in me, and he and my dad became very close friends. And through Joe, nice to be around.
Before you get to Joe Press, I'd like to ask go ahead.
Back up a little bit. While I was down and growing up at 60th Street, stickball was one of our big means of.
Were you a two-sword man?
Oh yeah, yeah, right. I could hit it pretty far, and surprisingly enough, it apparently stood us in good stead. Any friend who played it, as far as making contact. In fact, I used to find myself throwing a ball against the wall and reaching down with the stick and then try to hit it as it come off the wall if there was no one else around to play with.
You remember in those days you could play ball in the street and there weren't that many automobiles.
That's the big thing. Yeah, you didn't. Well, we had Roosevelt Hospital on one side of us there, so it was just a straight wall, although they had a big, it wasn't a moat, but it was a big sort of a ditch where they went down about a yard, a story or so, And if the ball got down there, it took a little doing to get it back up out of it. But other than that, we were able, and they,
how about the kids in that era? They didn't have some of the involvements that, unfortunately, a lot of the young people have today. We were too busy playing in the streets, I think.
Right. Yeah, you didn't have any other problems. In fact, I never saw a basketball until I got up to the Bronx.
Did you play football in college? In high
school? No, my father said he wouldn't allow me. He said, there's a chance you might make a ball player. So he said, why gamble on getting banged up? He said, two sports is enough. And he said, although Johnny Law was the football coach at Manhattan when I was in college, and they wanted me to come out as a left-handed passer because it was something unusual. And I wanted to play, but he said no dice. So
now, you had a brother who was quite a good player in basketball.
Basketball, yes. My brother Billy, yeah.
Billy, right. And how many other children were there in the family?
There's Barney and Tom. Tom has passed away. My brother Barney's retired from the fire department in New York, and he was also the captain of basketball in Manhattan. Around 40, 41, and around there, 40.
Did they get into baseball at all?
No, neither one of them. Billy went into basketball.
Yeah.
He's getting a pension. He's got 5 years in. And
is that from the BAA or the...
Yes, but it's, he was not in the original one. He was done before, so, but they included him in. Gene Connolly apparently worked on it for them.
Yeah.
And so they're getting it. Al Servi, who I worked with, was in the Hall of Fame of basketball. Yeah. He's getting it, and but those fellas who are in the same position I'm in baseball and football also. So it's one of those things.
Is there anything else you'd want to add about the time you were growing up in your early life, street life?
Well, the only thing was you try to. there was very few problems. We had. Different ethnic groups throughout the area there. You had Polish, black, white, Irish, Jewish, you had it all. They were all there. And they managed, because they were all trying to get along,
sure.
And they'd help each other. And we found our life to be a lot more simpler than it is today. It wasn't people trying to crawl over. They were trying to help each other move up a little.
That's what Jimmy Cagney said in his biographies, you know, what a conglomeration it was of ethnic strains where he grew up in New York.
And
he says everybody got along pretty good. He said, and it was, as we were agreeing before, it was a different world than the one we see today.
Oh, yes.
Now, let's pick up about the first interest that you had on the part of Joe Press, who was a semi-pro?
Yeah, Joe had me come over and play over in Long Island under the Queensboro Bridge. They had
a recreation park.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I played, first played there.
That was a Springfield Grays?
That was one of them, yeah. It was actually in Springfield Gardens, I guess, in that area, but it was the Springfield Grays, I remember that. I forget the name of the club that I first played with over there.
Was it were you always a first baseman? I know that you played outfield a few games in the majors.
Yeah, I played in 38 when they brought over Camilli.
Yeah.
Yes, like in high school, actually, in the prep, I came out for the team when I was my sophomore year. Well, as I said, well, what do they need?
Yeah.
They said, pitchers. I said, well, I'm a pitcher, so. But after my walk half the ballpark, but I had a chance to swing the bat, and I got a base hit with the bases loaded, so they finally decided I was a first baseman, so that's how I...
That's right, it went.
I got there by intent.
I've got here that you graduated from Manhattan. Apparently, you didn't marry until after your playing days ended, is that correct?
Yes, it was. I was married right after the 42 World Series.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is this a girl who you'd known for a good long time?
No, it's a girl that grew up in Jersey City, a very beautiful girl, and I had met her in a nightclub with a friend of mine and hadn't seen her for quite a while, and finally, through Mel Logan, who was one of the scouts for Brooklyn, he mentioned to me that he had met a friend of mine, and he mentioned her name, Ronnie Mackin, and I said, gee whiz, I said, I've been trying to get her address for quite a while. So he got it for me and the phone number, so I called and we started a date. And but then that, as I, there's a funny story connected with that also. That was in 37. And we went along pretty well together and we decided to get married. And finally, I had gotten the engagement and wedding ring. I bought it from a fellow who a lot of the ball players dealt with in Cincinnati. And so I gave her the engagement ring. And so after about a month or so, she decided that she didn't want to get married at that time. I said, all right, well, give me back the engagement ring. So I took it back with the wedding ring, and we had a safe at home. I put the two rings in the safe. And they laid there for 5 years.
Oh, my.
And we finally, we played it with the Yankees. They played an exhibition game in Kansas City. And her sister called me. Yeah. She lived there. One of her sisters lived in Kansas. She called me to come to the ball game. And on the way, I naturally invited her. And just before we left, she asked me to call home. Her mother and father were alive in Jersey City. So I called, and I happened to get my wife on the phone, and she said, well, I'd like to talk to you. So I said, fine. So it took 5 years, but we finally...
That's a great story.
Yeah, I think it's, especially with the keeping the rings, they're in the safe, and I had forgotten about them almost, and so I didn't have to go out and buy any more or anything.
No. Let me ask you a couple of questions now. You got me to your semi-pro days of playing for Joe Preston. I guess you played for other semi-pro teams, perhaps.
Yeah. Generally, I played with Bay Parkways for a while. And
yeah.
With there with Harry Hesser. Was
Ken going, Strong playing at that
Ken
time?
Ken was still playing a little bit. And,
yeah.
Geez, we had some great... you had a lot of little former minor leaguers, too.
Yes.
And he's a great football player from Yale. I'm trying to remember his name. Larry...
Not Larry Kelly.
It was Larry something.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's a big outfielder. It may not be Larry. Maybe I was thinking of Larry.
Bruce.
Bruce.
Wait a second.
Bruce,
I know
big
the guy
outfield.
You're talking about. It wasn't Caldwell, was it?
Bruce Caldwell.
Yeah.
Geez,
yeah.
He was great.
Yeah.
And of course, I should remember a lot more of the names, and they will come back to me.
Did you play against the Black Yankees?
Yep.
Guys like Gibson?
No,
and,
all of them. Yeah, I played with every one of them. Yeah, they had Showboat Thomas, and they had a bunch of them. And then, of course, the Cuban All-Stars with the Higo and that
sure.
group.
He must have been quite a ball player.
He was something else. He was something to see. Yeah, he was. And there were other fellas whose names would get away. And a lot of them played basketball with the team from Harlem.
The Globetrotters.
No, the other team. They named after the hall they had.
Renaissance.
Renaissance.
Yeah.
The Renaissance. Yeah.
And how about you played at a place called Erasmus Field?
Right.
Where the Bay Parkways
Bay
played.
That's where they.
And I remember going to a game there. And you remember the shape of that ballpark.
Right.
Left field was about 440 feet.
Right. The right field was
the shape. I saw, it's the only time, and I went to Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn, so I saw a lot of games there. I never saw anybody hit a ball over the left field fence, but I did see Gibson hit one over that.
Is that right?
That fence
yeah.
in
well,
left field.
Josh
and by a good,
good margin.
I never forget that.
Well, you know, but Joe Press, we I became quite friendly. We became real close friends. I did a little singing, and you know, if it rained, you didn't get paid. So he'd get some people in his stand. They would start a sprinkle. He used to hand me a megaphone. He'd say, go out and sing a couple of songs,
oh, nice.
Which I did. I sing a couple of songs just to keep him in the park. He wouldn't leave. So
oh, that's great.
I had to earn my
yeah.
keep a couple of ways.
I want you to know that I paid money to hear you sing. I went to the Brooklyn Strand Theater
with
and
Stan
you were
Lomax.
There with Stan Lomax, and you were damn good. I thought that was really
we,
great.
We had a lot of fun. Yeah.
So now we're at semi-pro days. How about the
Bill
first?
Bill Skiff played with us.
Yeah.
Harry Hess, Bill Skiff, gee, I'm trying to... the fellow who was the batting practice pitcher for the Yankees and the Red Sox.
Schreiber.
Paul Schreiber. That name's come back.
Woozy Fullerton. Fullerton was a pitcher also.
Yeah. Oh, gee. I ran across him He was tending bar out here in Jersey.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah, years later. I'm trying to think of some of the other. Well, of course, you had Dominic Torp.
Yeah.
Who was quite a...
Oh, he was a great athlete at City College, wasn't he?
NYU.
NYU,
right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Trying to think of that. And, of course, the Patty Smith was with the Bushwicks all the time to catch. He was a character. He became a millionaire.
What was the other first baseman? Eppie Barnes?
Was great. Oh, he's great. Yeah, Eppie finally owned the bar, too.
Al Cucinola.
Al played.
I got to tell you a funny story about Al Lopez, who, you know, was a teammate of yours, I think.
Yeah, I roomed with him 1 year.
Lopez told a story in the Little World Series, when Indianapolis was playing Montreal, he hears this big galoot yelling at him across the field on the Montreal team just before fielding practice. And he says, hey, Al, you know, he said, don't you remember me? So Lopez said, why should I remember you? He said, when I was a kid, I ran out on the field at Ebbets Field and tried to grab your hat after a game. He said, and you kicked my behind so hard, I still have the spike marks. It was Chuck Connors, you know, the guy.
Yeah, I know
So Lopez told me, he said, if I knew he was going to turn out that big, I never would have done
it. That's right. Al and Tony are still playing golf down there in Tampa.
Yeah, they live
in the area.
They play practically every day, I guess. They've been close friends for many, many years.
Yep.
Now, when did you first get your first bite about Major League ball?
Well, the Major Leagues was something.
Well, no, I mean, you know,
to be
minor league.
People.
Yeah.
Well, Paul Critchell.
Yeah.
You see, that the connection there was Paul and Joe Press were very close friends, and they see each other quite a bit. And that's how Harry Hess and Bill Skiff all got in with Paul Critchell, was through Harry, through Joe Press.
Yeah.
And of course, Harry had played minor league, and of course, Bill had played in the majors. He'd been with the Yankees a short while. And finally, Critchell came and see, and he said, well, we want to sign you. Mm-hmm. And so he and my dad met together in the old Dykeman Oval.
Oh, yes, I remember. Yeah.
And he signed the contract there, and they paid me all at $1,200 to sign.
Well, at least you got something for it, and they must have valued you, or you wouldn't have gotten
out. Yeah, well, that's it.
In those days, that was not, insignificant.
No.
And you had good years at Wheeling, Norfolk, and Columbus. And mm-hmm.
That was the pattern. Well, the Columbus was, I was there optioned on a deal with Pat Malone, went to the Yankees. Ricky made a deal for me because Don Hirst wouldn't report to the Columbus club. He was holding out.
Yeah.
So they got me to play. And I was hitting about 350 something when I broke my leg, just sliding in the home plate on a home run inside the park.
Yeah.
And that was in 1935.
Now, did they send you to Wheeling or Norfolk?
Yes, the Yankees sent me to Wheeling. In fact, Paul Critchell took me by the hand. He went down with me in the train and delivered me. And funny, getting off the train, there's a big crowd at the station at Wheeling. Holy cow, a big crowd. I said, boy, is this the way they welcome the ball players here? He said, well, he sort of mumbled something. So I got off, and then I found out later they were welcoming either the football team or the cheerleading team who had won a state championship or something. That sort of brought me here, right?
Brought down to earth.
Right in a hurry, yeah. And another case there was, I remember playing a game there. Jack Sheehan was our manager, and he was still playing a little third base. And we were behind, I guess, 3 or 4 runs one day, and I'm on first base, and I think I see the steal sign. And back then, you're 3-4 runs behind, you didn't steal. The game wasn't played that way. You didn't try to steal. Take them one base at a time. Not like today. They run any time. It's a whole different ball game. I took off at second base, and I'm throwing out from here to the wall. And now I have to go past Sheen, who's coaching at third base, and our dugout was at third base. So as I walked by, he said, what happened, bud? I said, gee, Mr. Sheen, I said, I thought, he said, wait a minute. Stop right there. He says, don't go to thinking you're weak in the ball club. So he taught me a quick lesson.
Well, that's great. Now, let me ask you this. What was your parents' attitude about you playing Major League Ball? Did they encourage
you? Well, my
you?
Father was a little semi-pro ball player around 60th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. He was a little left-handed pitcher. See, he was left-handed. He was the oldest of his family. I'm the oldest of mine, the only left-hander. And my older daughter is left-handed, so it came down three generations. The oldest were all left-handed. But my dad, I saw him pitch a little semi-pro ball right there at 60th Street, so it sort of came along.
But in other words, they encouraged you.
They
were not against your playing, maybe.
My mother was rather sickly, and but she'd take a great interest. She was quite a rooter. In fact, he wouldn't sit with her. He'd get off by himself. He didn't want anybody to know him. But she'd be rooting, and they knew who she was.
Let me ask you this. Did you have any qualms about signing with the Yankees? Admittedly, they were probably the greatest organization in baseball at the time. But you knew that Lou Gehrig was was the resident.
Our outlook was that there are other clubs. If you produce, you'll play somewhere.
Sure, I could understand that.
In fact, I remember after the season at Columbus, Lou and I were at a charity affair at Dempsey's restaurant, and he said to me, he said, hey, geez, I hear you're a pretty good ball player. And he said, they're talking about you taking my job. And I said, I started to laugh. I said, nobody's going to take your job. I said, I'm just looking to try to get into the major leagues. I said, but your job, no. Nobody's going to be taking it. But he had that way about him, very gracious.
The interesting thing about Gehrig is that people always think of him as playing ball at the Bakerfield baseball field, but actually he never played up there at the complex at Dyckman. He played when the Columbia University baseball diamond was on the campus at 116th Street.
I know it, yeah.
And he had a record home run that wound up on the steps of the Butler Library there.
I know, I've worked out. Paul Critchell used to have me work out with the Columbia Club in the fall. What was the coach's name?
The guy from Fordham, Jack.
Not Jack Coffey. Not very fine gentleman.
He was a famous pitcher.
Yes, he was. He pitched in Major League. Paul had me work out with the Columbia Club in the fall.
That's interesting. Do you have any particular memories about your minor league playing days? The teams you play for, the managers or the ballparks?
Well, of course, in 34, I played for Bill Skiff, who I had played with semi-pro ball up here. I could run pretty well, and he had me run, and we won everything because we had Eddie Sawyer was on that ball club, and we won the playoffs and everything else there. Bobby Stevens is a little shortstop. He was on the ball. He was on his way down.
Are we talking about
Norfolk?
Norfolk, right.
1934, and that's the year I hit 360 there, and I broke the league record of 56 stolen bases, which held up for 20 years until the.
That's interesting because I never realized that you had that kind of speed.
Yeah, and Bill would use it wherever possible, and he was always. He turned out to be such a friend, he was always trying to promote me, so he'd make sure I'd look good. He'd have me doing whatever I could to better myself. And then I was in spring training with the Newark Club in 35. Bob Shorkey was running the Newark Club then. And that's, in fact, my Wheeling, Jimmy, All-American Football Club, Auburn, Jimmy Hitchcock. Was our third baseman, and he's another fellow from Georgia.
Hitchcock played at Auburn, I think.
He did. Yeah.
And a very good ball player.
Yeah, and then his brother came along and also played. But Jimmy ended up marrying Bob Shorkey's daughter, and he became, I think, the president or the head of the state athletic board in Alabama.
I didn't realize
he died a young man.
How about the ballparks? What were they like? I mean,
well, somewhere, you know, they were almost like the major league as far as one be long and one be short, whether it be right field or left field.
Did you play any games at that famous ballpark in Nashville, Sulphur Dome?
No. That's
one that I know was
going. No, we had one in Beckley, though. If you hit the ball over the left field fence, it went down 300 feet. Over the fence, it went down straight down 300 feet. The fence was right at the edge of the mountain. They had cut the ballpark out of the mountain.
That's
not too many people got near that left field fence. Nobody tried to catch one up against it.
That would be Beckley, West Virginia.
That's right. Beckley, West Virginia.
Now, let's see. At what time did you get the feel that Brooklyn was interested in you, or was it a complete surprise to you?
It was. Well, a funny thing happened, and I always tell it. The Bear Lewis fight was in the winter of 35, 35-36, or the fall. And I went to the fight. It was in the stadium. And we ended up in the press room after the fight with all the newspaper men. And Colonel Rupert came in, and he introduced me to him. And he had that little accent.
Yeah.
And he says, Hassett, you went to Manhattan College. He said, yeah. Yes, Colonel, I did. Did you come from New York? I said, yes. He said, good, we'll keep you in New York. So as I always said, he did. He saw me to Brooklyn, but I was still in New York.
I thought he more or less left most of that to Weiss.
He did. But I mean, he was being in conversation.
It was interesting. Wade Hoyt used to tell that great story about but he was battling for an increase, and
that's
Rupert says, what do you think I am, a millionaire?
You know, that whole story, Wade told me the story, because we got to be pretty friendly when he was over
with
at Brooklyn.
Dodgers,
you know? Yeah. We New York boys got to stick together.
But he
said that he had all those buildings up on the wall. That's how he got around to that. See, what happened was the colonel was called out of the room while Wade was in there waiting to talk to him about an increase. And he's looking at the pictures of all these buildings. So when the colonel comes back, he says, Colonel, what are these buildings? Yes. Hoyt said, that one, $8 million, and this one cost me $10 million, and that one, $20 million. And then he got talking about the raise, and he said, what do you think I am, a millionaire? Which I think is, that's a cute story.
Well, listen, you came to Brooklyn, and I can remember some interesting games that you played in Brooklyn, and of course, you can remember a lot more than I can. You must have had some games that particularly stood out in your mind in the course of your 7 years in the majors. Of course, the World Series must have been particularly important.
Well, of course, yes, that was.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of your time with Brooklyn, because I remember a couple of games. It must have been outstanding games for you, but you tell me what your...
Actually, very few of the games that first year, the only fact was that I was playing and great to be playing, and that was all. I was in the major leagues, and boy, I'd feel badly every time we got beat, and we got beat rather often. So,
was kind of rough, I meant.
Yeah, for the Phillies. In fact, my father used to come with friends, and I'd get angry because he had them there, and I didn't want to talk because I was angry at the fact we lost again.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, but you got a couple. I said, yeah, the hits don't mean nothing, you don't win. So, that was a different era.
I will try to refresh your memory about one particular game which I saw at Baker Bowl. It was early in the season of 1937 when the Dodgers had those uniforms, the green and tan road uniforms. And the Dodgers were losing by one run, and going into the first of the ninth inning with Johnny Hudson on base, Gil Brack hit a ball that Chuck Klein couldn't handle, and Hudson tied the score. And you came to bat about two innings later, extra innings, and one of the few times I saw you really pull a ball hard, you hit it over that fence with two men on base, and won the ball game.
It's funny.
That probably doesn't mean anything to you.
It doesn't register at all. It's funny.
I remember another one. You mentioned that you were occasionally called on to play the outfield when Dolph Camilli came to the team in 38. And at that time, I remember you and Camilli, one of you got a triple and one of you got a single against Clay Bryant at a game when Bryant was really throwing aspirin tablets.
Yeah, he could throw them too.
And you won that game in extra innings also. That, but you had either hit a triple to left center or it was a
probably
single.
Probably wherever I hit the left center.
But that was a game which I remember you being a strong factor in. But now let's get to talking about the managers a little bit.
Well, I was just going to say that 36 season.
Yeah.
Wade Hoyt and I were in the Edgewater Beach Hotel. It was getting toward the end of the season, and I was hitting about 315, 320 at the time. And as I say, we had another week or two to go, maybe three. Because I know I ran into a slump, but then come back out of it and ended up about 310. But we were in having a beer at the bar in the Edgewater Beach Hotel in Chicago. And Casey, who was our manager at the time, and Edna, his wife, were sitting at a little table. So it came about 11:45, and we had a curfew at 12. So we finished up our beer, and we're heading out. And Casey yelled for me, "Hey, Bud, come here." And he said, "Sit down." So he called the waiter over. He said, "What are you drinking?" I said, "Beer." So he said, "Bring him a beer." He said, "I want you to sit down." He says, "I owe you something." He said, "I got to tell you something." He said, "I owe you beer, or maybe more." He said, our organization signed you, and nobody in the organization saw you play. He said, "I took the word of all my friends from the American Association." And he says, "I took their consensus of opinion as to whether you could make it or not." And he said, "You made the deal stand up pretty well, so I owe you a couple of beers."
That's an interesting story.
Yeah. So but I never realized that nobody had seen me play. I know Heinie Groh was one fellow who did see me, and he was scouting to somebody else, but I'm sure that at the Giants, I believe he was. But I know Terry wanted to sign me, and the Yankees weren't going to let me play in New York.
That's an interesting aspect.
He wanted me, and
Now it's interesting. It tells you something about the managerial position in the major leagues. If a guy has the talent on his team, he can be a great manager.
Right.
He could also be a great manager without the talent, but the team isn't going to win.
That's simple. Yeah. He know the game, and there's nothing he can do about it.
You
just do the best he can, and that's it. Whether this football situation, I was just reading about the Giants here. Whether that's another one of those things, I don't know.
But you know, it's funny, Warren Spahn pitched for Stengel with the Boston Braves when they were...
Well, he was an 18-year-old when I was up there.
And he also pitched for Stengel when the Mets came into being at the Polo Grounds, and he always had that comment. He said, "I played for Stengel before and after he was a genius."
Which I think is great. Very good thinking.
But you know, you have a guy like Bill McKechnie, who was a great manager, and he never, outside of the years he had Cincinnati, had the similar situation with the Braves.
Incidentally, talking about him, you know, he had all those sinker ball pitches out there.
Yeah.
Bucky Wallace had all, and they had a bunch of them. He used to wet the infield from home plate out about 12 feet.
Is that right? This is McKechnie.
Yeah. Each sopper. And you'd hit the ball on that ground and hit that stuff and you'd blup, 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 blup.
Hello?
Those are little tricks they used to use. Oh, boy.
I got to ask you a couple of questions about the clubhouse atmosphere on those ball clubs. Now, you were at Brooklyn. What was it like there? I just have some of the guys' names that, you know, you may want to comment on. You were there at a time and you had Babe Phelps and Jimmy Booker and Johnny Cooney, guys like that.
Well, Johnny was my first roommate.
He was a fine outfielder.
He was a fine pitcher. Man. Yes, they always forget that he pitched for about 4 or 5 years before he went back down and came back up as an outfielder.
Were you with the team in Chicago when Mungo went berserk and had that ruckus there?
And then he got out of there when he left.
He ruined a set of match luggage that Booker had. Grimes had been visiting at his farm in New Haven, Missouri, and the hotel hollered for him, and that was quite a mess.
Well, I was with him when he jumped the ball club with Eddie Zeltner.
I remember that.
Yeah, he came back home here. Yeah. And I remember he said, "There's only one real professional, Johnny Cooney, on the ball club." Mungo made the statement.
Yeah.
And Johnny Cooney said to me, he says, "Geez, he thinks this is a country club, only one pro." Golf club, one pro.
He was a fabulous character. You know, he and Paul Richards, when they were rookies at Hartford, they roomed them together because they were both sleepwalkers and they couldn't room them with other guys. And according to the way Richards tells this story, he says one night, he said, Mungo walked into a closet and he woke up and started screaming. He says, and he woke me up. He says, I found out I was under the bed.
That's cute.
How about Ben?
Ben was something else. I remember playing one game and he had a short fuse. He could get mad in a hurry. So they got me playing left field and Crosley field, and they had that little matter, terrace too. Yeah. And he says, the ball hit in the left center, and I go over, and I start to back up. And you know, backing into a terrace with the ground going up, the first thing you know, your heels hit the high part. And back over I went on my back, and the ball fell in there. It was about the first inning. So, Jesus, as soon as the inning was, I ran in. I said, Jesus, man, terribly so. I apologize. I said, you know, I'm a lousy outfielder. I said, what the heck? I quieted him down before he could get too mad. But that's what you'd have to do with Van.
Well, I heard quite a few stories about him. I was out visiting my son in Washington, and Lonnie Fry lives in Snohomish, Washington.
I wish I'd have known when I was out there. I'd have looked him up because Lonnie and I were very close.
And he was telling me of his early years trying to play at Brooklyn, and of course he was one of Mungo's favorite targets.
I know it.
And oddly enough, Lonnie was not too complimentary about Stengel. And I always thought Stengel doted on him. He said that, although he got along with Stengel, he said there were instances where he felt Stengel was very impatient with young ball players. He named one guy in particular, Frank Scaff. He gave Scaff a very hard time, you know.
Well, I think Scaff and Geraghty, Ben Geraghty, came up together. They both played at Villanova. I think what he was trying to do, he thought Frankie was a quiet fella, and he thought maybe he'd give him some hustle.
No, I just wondered about
that. You know, talking about the Mungo, my first game, opening day, 1936. Yeah. That thing with Fry and Bartel.
Oh, no, they were rolling down the first baseline. I remember that,
I was involved. I was the first baseman.
Yeah.
And Bartel bunted after Mungo knocked him down.
Yeah.
And the ball's bunted. He's trying to bunt and then come over and cut him.
Yeah.
And luckily, the ball's bunted a little hard and a little over toward the line, so I knew what was happening.
Yeah.
So I grabbed the ball and made the play myself rather than...
Of course.
I run across the bag, and now I turn around, and 10, 15 feet beyond the bag, Bartel's laying on the ground. Mungo tripped him, and now he's diving after him. I go over and try to get in, and next thing I know, I got Bartel onto me. Luckily, I had both hands out on the ground.
Yeah.
And I say, hey, Dick, stay here.
Yeah.
And our boys are pulling Mungo away,
yeah,
and all the Giants are around me, and she said they could have Sundayed me to death, except they could see I wasn't trying to punch him.
Right.
I was just laying there. But I nothing but white uniforms around me. I figured I'm going to get it. But this is my opening day in the major league.
Well, that's really something.
I didn't know what, right in a hurry.
well, Mungo, I can remember DeRocher getting into a fight with Zeke Benura. Of course, Benura was not a fighter, and
he was
a clumsy guy at first base, and DeRocher caught him, and they fought, and Mungo came out of the dugout carrying a bat, and the umpire grabbed the bat. I think it was, I don't know if it was Beans Reardon or not, but that was another episode of which Mungo was a part. Another guy I saw who was a teammate of yours, I want to be sure this tape is still running, was Tom Winsett. I saw him in
McKenzie,
Tennessee.
Tom Winsett,
And he is selling real estate. He's living in West Palm Beach now.
Is he?
Yeah. But we had about an hour and a half together, and he was telling me, he said, I can't tell you why I wasn't a better ball player as a major leaguer. He said, the ball looked like a grapefruit in the minor leagues. He said, I could get up. He said, I did have one important hit, he remembered. He said, when Hubble was going for that, it was at the Polo Grounds on a holiday weekend.
And I remember he hit one
he said that at that time he hit a triple or something with the bases loaded.
Mm-hmm.
But, and he hit a couple of you know, he did hit some home runs for the Dodgers, but that was a real surprise that he was.
I had played with him at Columbus.
Yeah.
We had him and Nick Cullip in the same outfield.
Oh, yeah.
We had a pretty good ball club. Yeah. And we had some great pitchers. Klinger, Bob Klinger, Cooper.
Right. And Walt Cooper was some kind of pitcher.
Yeah. We had what the heck was his name? Was a catcher, pitcher, coach, and everything else.
Oh,
Polish name.
Ryba. R-Y-B-A, yeah.
Reba.
Yeah.
Mike Reba. And then we had a couple others that made the major.
Well, you had Bordigray. He was another character.
He showed up with the goatee and a mustache.
Yeah, he
36. It's the first time I ever saw any guy with a goatee.
There's a great story about him when George Earnshaw joined the club.
Right.
Earnshaw was pitching, and in a game he was winning by one run. Bordigray made a terrible error. I think I've got the story wrong. He was leading by several runs, and Bordigray dropped a very easy fly ball and allowed two or three runs to come in so that the margin was just one run.
Yeah.
And then at the next inning, the last turn bat for the other team, some guy hit a ball that looked like it was going to be a triple off the right center field fence at Ebbets Field, and Bordigray climbed halfway up the fence and caught it. A fantastic catch. And as he was coming off the field, he had saved the game from Earnshaw. Stengel said to Earnshaw, he said, "Tell you what, George," he says, "I'm going to hold him and you can bite him on the leg."
I can just see that, too.
Tell me about Burley Grimes.
Well, we seem to have problems. Burley and I never seem to hit it off. And he pulled me out of a game. We were playing the Cubs one day. The man on first and second, and Cubs are at bat. And it's a bunting order. I came in to charge for the bunt. They bunted the ball to me. And I reached to make the play for the ball. I was going to go to third base with the ball because I had the time to throw him out. And as I reached, I looked and dropped the ball, and everybody said, "Well, he stopped the game there, brought Cooney in, took me right off first base, and sent me in." So 12 years later, 1949, that was 37. 49, he's working for the Yankees, and I had just finished managing Newark for the Yankees, so we were at the Yankee Victory Dinner, and he called me over in the corner and apologized for that.
That's nice.
Yeah, it totally took him 12 years to get around with it. He finally made it.
Woody English was mad at him for bringing him to Brooklyn. He liked Woody.
Yeah.
And he wanted him to play for him.
Yeah, I know. I found out later through his first wife that we had religious differences. I didn't know where he got them, but those things I'd rather not get into.
No, there's no need to. Had an interesting observation. He was assigned, at the time that he lost his job with Brooklyn as manager, a man who was an executive at the Brooklyn Trust Company was a factor in Grimes' being fired. Now, that seems odd, but the Brooklyn Trust Company...
McLaughlin.
There was a lot of money outstanding.
McLaughlin was a fellow, as I remember the name.
But according to Grimes, he said, this particular guy, I don't think it was McLaughlin, this particular fellow was at Princeton University, and I was sent down there to scout a ball player. And this was the ball player, he said. And he said, "I turned him down." He said, so it took him a while to get back at me.
Well,
but that's just an interesting story.
That's a good story.
Woody English told a great story about Tuck Steinbeck. Steinbeck came up with the Cubs.
Right.
And in the 1932 World Series, the Yankees and the Cubs were really going at it because of Mark Koenig's small share that the Cubs voted.
Right, I remember, yeah.
And the language was something. Even the commissioner said, "I learned words." Landis said, "I learned words I never heard before." And he said, "I think I've heard plenty of them." So, but the interesting thing was that Steinbeck got thrown off the Cub bench by the umpire for using some of that language. He said, and this is what English talking, he said, "Steinbeck wouldn't say God if he was in church." he said he was a typical right. clean cut.
Oh, you very much so, yeah.
And a handsome guy, and
beautiful.
He dressed well, and
You know, his brother-in-law was Wayne King.
Yes, I know. He married Alice, I forget her name. Yeah, but
Tuck and I were very close, and of course he was over with the Yankees with me too, so...
There's a guy who had plenty of talent. I always thought that he should have done better in the major leagues than he did.
You know, he had the greatest arm, and he threw like a girl. It was the funniest thing. He'd make a funny throw, but geez, that a ball would carry.
But he was, you know, he had speed.
Yeah, he could do it all.
He could do everything, and he'd occasionally get you the long ball, and he came up as a golden boy after the Cubs, somehow or other, it just never worked. Any of these other guys?
I think he got 14 years in, though, so I guess he's hung around for...
He's living out in Sherman Oaks, so but he's not too well. He's married again. I don't know what
is that right?
To you.
Yeah. He worked for Brooklyn for quite a while, I think, in the Dodgers.
Yes, he was in group sales.
Group sales, as I remember, yeah.
Joe Stripp.
Joe was quite a character.
He had all his teeth pulled because he had a bad arm, you remember?
His theory was, play 100 games, and the other 50 I'll tack on the end of my career.
You know,
that's the way he looked. We used to call him Johnson & Johnson. He always had something wrong with him.
The funny part of it was, is that Joe Stripp...
And he was a hell of a ball player.
I thought he was a fine ball player.
He was a good ball player.